In a few minutes, the stingray attack that killed crocodile hunter Steve Irwin. But now it's time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Last week, the Census Bureau released its latest estimate of poverty in the United States. In an op-ed in Sunday's Washington Post, Nicholas Eberstadt wrote that the figures are sobering, but also flawed and misleading. Given changes in American families, more access to credit, better nutrition, better housing, and better health care, he argues that many of the people who are now counted as poor actually have dramatically higher living standards than their counterparts in the 1960s when the poverty rate was designed. So how should we measure poverty? Are you poor if you have two cars, cable TV, and central air? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk at npr.org. Nicholas Eberstadt is the Henry Wendt Scholar in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us now by phone from RFK Stadium in Washington, D.C., where he's spending his Labor Day holiday watching the Nationals play the St. Louis Cardinals. Thanks for taking time out. What's the score?
It was tied when I got to the phone, 0-0.
All right. We should say that you take issue with the U.S. official poverty rate itself and are careful to point out this should not be confused with indifference to the plight of the poor.
What I'm talking about is the accuracy of the poverty rate itself, which suggests that the number of people suffering from a constant standard of deprivation over time has been rising in the United States. There's a wealth of evidence from other sources that shows that in purely terms of consumption, the lowest levels, the lowest strata of the United States have been heading in the right rather than the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the same thing as saying that poverty doesn't exist in the United States. It's also not the same thing as saying that people aren't poor if they have a television set. The level of acceptable deprivation in the United States is a political decision the society as a whole has to make, but that's not what our argument about the poverty rate right now is all about.
Well, without getting too technical, explain to us how the poverty rate is calculated now, as it has been, for the past 50 years or so?
Well, the poverty rate was unveiled in 1965 during the advent of the War on Poverty. It was a technical measure by some economists at our Social Security Administration, and they wanted to come up with a sort of a set of income thresholds, poverty lines, which they'd be able to use for judging whether families were in serious deprivation or not. Taking the data they had at hand, quite ingeniously, they devised a set of poverty thresholds for various family size, which were basically based upon the budget, the household food budget, a nutritionally adequate but very modest household food budget called a thrifty food plan. They multiplied the cost of that by 3, more or less, and said this would be the poverty line for American families. Over the past 40-plus years, that poverty line has held constant except for changes due to inflation. It's been adjusted upwards for inflation, but it's supposed to be an absolute rather than a relative measure of deprivation. It's supposed to capture people falling below some certain constant standard of poverty.
And one can see the advantages of having a consistent level. You're measuring the same thing over years and years and years and years.
Exactly so.
What has changed that you think that makes this way of measuring it inadequate?
There was a flaw built into the poverty rate at the very outset, which wasn't so troubling at the time, but has become more and more problematic with the passing years. The flawed assumption was that people at the lowest ends of the American income spectrum would only be able to spend as much as their annual income, that their expenditures would be, in other words, identical to whatever annual income level they were reporting.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that rich or poor, people in advanced industrial societies can almost always scrape up more money to spend in a bad year than their annual income would, you know, by itself strictly suggest. And what's happened over the past decades is that the discrepancy between reported income and reported spending for the bottom fifth of our society has steadily widened to the point where nowadays, on a very routine basis, the bottom fifth of our income spectrum reports spending twice as much as they report taking in that given calendar year.
Mm-hmm. And that's due, you suggest, to the greater availability of credit, particularly to people of lower incomes. And also, you say that there are a lot of people who have good years and bad years and bounce back and forth, and their spending is based on their presumptions about next year when things will be better.
Well, the United States is a society where there's a tremendous amount of churning and mobility for good or for ill all the time, and people's incomes bounce around from year to year. And the bouncing around, the year-to-year variance, seems to have been fairly progressively growing over the last 30 years or so. And as you just mentioned, that will mean that in a given bad year, someone is measured as being poor, but they're temporarily poor, and they may be spending the way that they see their long-term status or patterns holding up. The Census Bureau's surveys, their across-time surveys called the SIP survey, suggest that there's really a rather small proportion of the poor who are stuck month by month by month below the poverty income level straight over time, year in, year out. Mm. The SIP survey suggested that something like one out of 16 households that experiences a month of poverty in a four-year period is actually stuck at that low level for all 4 years, all 48 months of that low, at that very low level.
We can let you know that according to the Associated Press, Ramon Ortiz of the Nationals has a no-hitter going through six innings, and I think that explains the cheer we just heard a few minutes ago.
It wasn't about the poverty rate, I assure you that.
I suspect not. Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. This is Roger. Roger's calling us from Oklahoma City.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Roger, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, okay, fine. I'm driving. This is a pretty weak signal. I would like to hear some people talk, your guests talk about the importance of relative poverty's index of the cost, possibly of political, social instability, crime, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the National Gini Index, which is the ratio of the top to the low, is probably a more accurate indicator of possible political consequences than any absolute level of poverty, no matter how defined. Any comments on that?
Nicholas Eberstadt?
I'll take a crack at it. I don't know how well I'll hit it. It's a very good question. The poverty rate is not meant to be the poverty rate is not meant to be a misery index. It's an income level. It can't tell us anything about crime, violence, family breakdown, drug use, or any of the many other troubling social trends in our country. Since it's only an absolute measure rather than a relative measure of deprivation, it by definition won't tell us anything about widening income differences in our society. I don't think there's any doubt at this point. There's a wealth of evidence to suggest that income differences in the United States have been pretty steadily widening since the early 1970s. Part of that growth in income inequality, if you will, is this difference in year-to-year variations for given households. Part of it is a growth in permanent, if you might consider them that way, permanent differences in income between households.
Hmm. Did he get a single, double, or a triple, maybe a home run, Roger?
I beg your pardon?
Do you think he hit a single, double, triple, or a home run?
I have no idea.
All right.
Thanks for taking my call.
Maybe a walk to first.
Well, that's maybe. That could be. He must be another economist. He doesn't know what you said either. The question being, what's wrong if we've had this consistent measurement over time? What does it distort? What does it not tell us that we ought to know?
What it's not telling us, it can't tell us anything about misery, about social deprivation like crime or violence or family breakdown. It isn't telling us anything accurate over time about the consumption levels of people in the most disadvantaged strata of our society. The advantage of a month-to-month income report for American administrators is that can help determine who needs to qualify for social programs. it's not good enough to say I consumed $50,000 worth of goods and services last year. You want to know what people have as by way of income or purchasing power on a month-to-month basis if you want to determine eligibility mm-hmm. for social need programs. But in terms of understanding the broad trends of material deprivation for our society, you'd want to know about purchasing power at the lower ends of our spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to, just finally, are you trying to say that by looking at this, are there many fewer people who are relatively poor, do you think, or more, or is that not what you're trying to talk about?
I'm telling you it's an entirely different dimension. I could construct in the United States by drawing lines around communities, one community which has a poverty level income report, a very high poverty rate, where crime is rampant, where drug use is rampant, where out of wedlock births and single parent families are prevalent. And I could draw you another one constructed, for example, heavily of new age and immigrants, where for the same income level, there's very little crime, relatively strong families, very little drug use, and so on. Many of the children from that latter community would be going on to be dentists and MBAs. Many of the children from the first community would be going on to jail. So the income levels by themselves wouldn't help you predict what was going to be happening to the children of those two different communities.
Hmm. Nicholas Eberstadt, thanks very much. Appreciate your time today. You get back to the ballgame. I think it's still 0-0.
Thank you very much.
Nicholas Eberstadt is the Henry Wendt Scholar in Political Economy at the American Enterprise Institute. His op-ed ran in yesterday's Washington Post. You can find a link to it and to all of our previous opinion pages at the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. And when we come back, it's farewell to the crocodile hunter.